Himself in his remarks made only vague promises of fixing Flint's pipes, specifying no concrete dollar figure. Instead, he touted the work of non-profits, charities, and philanthropists in providing assistance to Flint residents. He even cited approvingly the $2,500 raised by a group of prisoners in Indiana. A central aim of Obama's remarks was to perpetuate the cover-up of the criminal responsibility of government officials at all levels for the disaster. He made a point at the beginning of the speech of noting the presence of Michigan Governor Rick Snyder and chastising those who responded by booing. "We're doing business here," Obama said. Obama blamed the crisis on poor decisions, claiming that no one consciously wanted to hurt the people of Flint. Instead, officials simply weren't attentive to potential problems when acting under budgetary pressures. This is not to sort out every screw-up that resulted in contaminated water. In fact, officials did not merely make poor decisions. They actively conspired to ensure that the water source was switched to the Flint River despite ample warnings of the consequences. Documents show that state environmental officials altered reports in order to minimize the dangers of lead in Flint's drinking water. When residents began to complain of the contaminated water, local, state, and federal officials worked to discredit these complaints and cover up their responsibility. Obama wants to avoid an analysis of the screw-ups because his administration is itself culpable. The Federal Environmental Protection Agency moved to isolate and silence Miguel del Toro, an EPA official who warned of elevated lead levels and said that the city was not using corrosion control. The agency regularly allows cities throughout the country to violate the government's own standards. Both Democratic and Republican officials were involved in the decision to shift Flint's water supply to the polluted Flint River. This included former Democratic State Treasurer Andy Dillon, who signed off on the decision to shift the Flint water supply. The crisis in Flint is part of a generalized crisis produced by decades of deindustrialization, budget cuts, the elimination of regulations on corporations, and growing social inequality. Basic social services are being starved for funds while the Obama administration lavishes countless billions on the Pentagon war machine and handouts to America's wealthy elite. Obama's remarks on Wednesday were a declaration to the people of Flint and throughout the country that nothing will change, no serious assistance will be provided, and that workers should simply stop complaining and be quiet. Detroit public school teachers end sick outs, face new legislative attacks, by Nancy Hanover. With American Federation of Teachers, AFT, President Randy Weingarten taking the lead, the Detroit Teachers Union instructed its membership at a mass meeting Tuesday afternoon to end their two-day sick out and return to work. The powerful work action in protest against the threat to withhold paychecks over the summer months had effectively shut the Detroit Public Schools DPS system. The teachers reluctantly acquiesced to the union's demand, but there was widespread skepticism over assurances from DPS emergency manager Stephen Rhodes that their paychecks would be forthcoming, and deep concern about the implications for their jobs, wages, benefits, and working conditions of a union-backed scheme under debate in the state legislature to reorganize the school district. At the meeting, union officials claimed victory, producing a letter from Rhodes reversing his previous statement that he could not guarantee payments to teachers after June 30th. The former federal judge presided over the 2013-2014 bankruptcy of Detroit, overseeing the slashing of city workers' pensions and health benefits, and the privatization of city assets. Speaking to the teachers at Tuesday's membership meeting, amid calls from the floor for strike action and denunciations of the union's inaction, Weingarten praised Rhodes, calling him transparent. She told the teachers, "He has been candid in the process. He is very frustrated. I think he is trying to do what he can." "They're just placating us," preschool teacher Julie Hamburg told the Detroit News after the meeting. "Our demands have been completely dismissed." On social media, one teacher asked, "Why did we have to go through this BS?" Another teacher replied, "We were used to it." A third wrote, "Completely. They had their agenda and we were part of it." The AFT and the Detroit Federation of Teachers, DFT, are supporting the DPS debt repayment plan pushed by Rhodes, Republican Governor Rick Snyder, Republicans in the state Senate, and Democratic state legislators. The plan has thus far been blocked by Republicans in the state House, who want to impose even more draconian provisions against teachers. These include a requirement that teachers reapply for their jobs in a newly organized school district, the decertification of teachers who take part in work actions, the abrogation of the contract with the DFT, and limitations on the union's ability to bargain with school authorities. Both rescue plans include the establishment of a financial review panel with dictatorial powers over the district's finances. Since teachers earlier this year carried out a series of sick-outs independently of the union to protest filthy and unsafe conditions in the schools, the AFT and the Detroit local have done everything in their power to line up school employees behind Snyder's plan in the hopes of maintaining their franchise and dues income under the new setup. By putting a stop to teacher sick-outs, the union is seeking to demonstrate to the ruling class its utility in policing the working class. The Snyder-Rhodes plan, supported by the AFT, is designed first and foremost to guarantee the investments of state bondholders. Moody's has repeatedly downgraded the district's debt, while Standard & Poor's put $469 million of district notes from 2011, 2012, and 2015 on credit watch as of March. Wall Street is making it clear that the DPS debt amassed under a series of state-appointed emergency managers must be repaid through the gutting of public education. On Tuesday, the Michigan House Appropriations Committee passed a plan that removes $200 million in transition funding provided by the Senate bill, all but guaranteeing the new school district will be bankrupt from the start. The House bill also allows non-certified teachers and waives requirements for student teaching for some educators, laying the basis for replacing current teachers with lower-paid new hires. The bill delays local school board governance until 2018, replacing it with a 7-member board whose majority is appointed by the governor. It also seeks to escalate privatization by eliminating a proposed Detroit Education Commission that could slow down the replacement of public schools with charters. Finally, the House attached an appropriation measure to the bill so that under Michigan law it cannot be repealed by voters. This hugely undemocratic subterfuge was employed to enact the Emergency Manager Law, PA 436, after the previous emergency manager law had been overwhelmingly defeated in a statewide referendum. Between a nuclear-armed state and a nuclear-armed alliance. Also today on the World Socialist website, Flint residents respond to Obama's speech on water crisis. French government presents labor law to the National Assembly. Leading member of far-right AFD named chief prosecutor in Berlin. Verizon strike enters fourth week. Two New Jersey transit unions reject contract agreement. Alberta wildfire forces 88,000 to evacuate Fort McMurray. More than 1 million people living in destitution in UK. Sri Lankan government begins implementing IMF austerity demands. Australian workers union to enforce cost-cutting at Arium Steel. May Day 2016, the U.S.-China conflict and the political crisis in Latin America, and deepening contradictions within the global economy. You can find all this and more today on the World Socialist website. This has been David Brown with the World Socialist website.
The World Socialist website is published by the International Committee of the Fourth International, the ICFI, the leadership of the World Socialist Movement, the Fourth International founded by Leon Trotsky in 1938. The World Socialist website relies entirely on the donations of readers and listeners for financial support. To give to the WSWS or to set up a regular monthly contribution, go to wsws.org/donate. We urge our listeners to join the International Committee of the Fourth International and one of its affiliated political parties and take up the struggle for socialism.
And coming up next on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM, freakradio.org, it's Bathrobes, Pierre's Broadsides, the flashback edition. Today is Thursday, May 5th, 2016. Flashback is to a November show, November 6th of 2 years ago, when I talked extensively about the, I call them dots for dodos or blue boxes for boneheads. That's the proposal to which has been implemented to mark the sidewalk and then intimidate or arrest those who do not keep their tables or whatever their so-called display devices are. That's whatever they set things down on Pacific Avenue and the adjacent streets. It could have a very significant impact on all kinds of groups, and it's essentially a continuation of the current policy, which has so far resulted in two arrests, or actually four arrests, arresting twice two street artists, most recently on Sunday, May 1st, when Alex Skelton and Geoff Jones were taken away. And I think they were released some hours later with all their property confiscated, facing another charge in court. I think this is two charges they now have they're going to have to deal with. You can learn more about that by going to Geoff Jones' Facebook page. I'm hoping to have a longer and more informative show, a more current show, on Sunday the 8th, but I can't guarantee it because serious cold has put me in a position where I can't really talk for long periods of time, and that sucks. But I do have interviews and hope to get a few more to play on Sunday. Those are going to include Mark Miron, attorney in Sacramento, who's fighting for the rights of Sacramento homeless, who put on a 3-month protest at City Hall, a nightly protest. An update, of course, from Salinas and Wes White, who's doing also a nightly protest at the Salinas City Hall against their anti-homeless laws. And whatever else I can throw together, health permitting, listen in, and hopefully you'll enjoy it.
And enough of the giggling. It's time for Bathrobes, Pierre's Broadsides. Today is November 7th, 2014. No, it's the 6th, actually. Sorry about that. So stay tuned.
Who owns the which is a question. Who owns a land? Ecocide, genocide, where is home? Ecocide, genocide, where is home? Ecocide, genocide, where is home? Ecocide, genocide, where is home?
And Let Your Home Be Free Radio for the next 2 hours, if you want. This is Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides. I'm Robert, and for the next 2 hours, I will be running through interviews on the street, sort of an analysis of the elections, at least that's what they call it. Possibly talking about a few stories, past and present, in the paper. And, yeah, mainly a lot of interviews, and that's where we're going to begin. Some recent stuff, and we're going to be leading into the upcoming shitty council meeting, or city council meeting, if you will. My opinion of the council is not a very high one, and I think its regard for the rights of poor and homeless people, renters, people of color, generally, is pathetically low. Perhaps standard in America for people in positions of power at the city level, but it sucks. And I think it's important to expose the problems that we have in the city and hopefully find some way through mutual consultation, discussion, understanding to solve them. So I also work with a group called HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. We meet every Wednesday. And at the Sub Rosa at 11, we have our meetings on 703 Pacific. You're invited to come. And we cooked up a few, I don't know if you call them events, sort of events, sure. Events, meetings for the next week. Tomorrow, a small number of us are going to visit the Santa Cruz City Attorney, John Barisoni, at his office at 333 Church Street, because John Barisoni has been laggard in getting back to one of our members. Pat Colby, who is a disabled activist, wants to be able to table downtown, as she has a right to do in the public space. But because of the peculiar laws in Santa Cruz, specifically the move-along law, she is not able to do this, given her disability, unless her situation is respected by, acknowledged by, and treated legally by the authorities. We shouldn't have to do this. The public spaces should simply be public spaces, and that should be that. But the whole downtown area, in fact, the whole American scene, has been infused with massive over-policing, militarization of the police, para-police, pseudo-police, snitch auxiliary to the police. I'm talking about the hosts. A whole network of paid people who are paid to run around and enforce regulations that have little or nothing to do with public safety and everything to do with, well, I suppose the motivation for the downtown ordinances that they enforce, which have to do with making only 2% of the sidewalk, actually it's only 1% right now, but it will be 2% if the city council passes its dots for dodos, or I call them performance pins legislation, which already has received a first reading. It sets up, you may have seen them, colored dotted areas on Pacific Avenue, on the sidewalk, that is, where you will be allowed to set up a table. You will be allowed to perform with, an open guitar case, where you will be allowed to vend local artwork or crafts that you have. Well, provided it's 12 inches off the ground, that's going to be a new regulation that they have. Provided it takes up more than 24 square feet, that is, acknowledging a doubling of the amount of space that they is actually legal under the old law, 12 square feet. That's three of those 2-by-2-foot squares, which nobody has any either ability or intention to respect. And the police don't enforce it anyway. It's an absurd law passed by the Matthews-Terrazas Council. And we have another such council, just as bad, if not worse, coming up this this next year, 2014-2015, after the elections. Anyway, Pat Colby needed to get from the city attorney a written acknowledgement that she would not be arrested or harassed for being at a spot for more than an hour. That's the law, the so-called move-along-every-hour law, which, as far as I know, is unique to Santa Cruz. Maybe there's one other city that has it. But it is it was created as a bastardization of an earlier understanding that was not a law, but that was an agreement between street performers to move along every hour after being asked by a merchant or another performer. But that's only after being asked and only an hour after being asked, not an hour after they began to play. It's called a rotation system. And it worked, as I understand it, fairly well for 22 years, but then was suddenly ended abruptly through the city council in 2003. And we've been suffering under that for the last 12 years. Huff did a vote, and we decided we wanted to essentially return to the voluntary street performers guidelines. No surprise there. We've always had that position. And also to eliminate the forbidden zones, which essentially make all the rest of the sidewalk except the current 1% or what will soon be 2% in, 30-35 days or so. Assuming the city council passes these performance pin dots that they have on the Pacific Avenue sidewalk. Currently, these forbidden zones extend to cover virtually all the sidewalk. You can't be 14 feet from a building. You can't be 14 feet from a kiosk, 14 feet from a sign, specifically a directory sign, 14 feet from a trash can, 14 feet from a compactor, 14 feet from a phone booth, 14 feet from an intersection, 50 feet from an ATM. This takes up virtually all the space, so that the merchants have about 10 times the amount of space that... And I'm talking about sidewalk space, not privately owned space, but space that the merchants have usurped because they have paid off city officials and leased off the public sidewalk. These are the areas where you see these sidewalk cafes, people sipping wine and their cappuccinos and so forth. Not that I haven't done the same. You know, I'm not so much of a wine sipper or even a cappuccino drinker, but I've been out there, you know, eating a breakfast at some place like Hoffman's. So, you know, it's going to be pleasant if you have the funds to do it. It can be pleasant if you aren't disturbed. Maybe you can sit down briefly at the tables in front of New Leaf before you get hustled off. I haven't heard of people being hustled off recently, but that has happened in the past. And these are supposed to be public areas available for all of us to use, whether we have money or not. And they're not anymore. Anyway, so... Pat Colby wants to be able to set up a table on Pacific Avenue and be in, within the law, not have to worry about fighting the police in court or facing a $300-and-some-dollar citation. It's $200 or $300 if you don't move along every hour and they give you a citation under this ordinance, which I think is blatantly unconstitutional, but has never been taken to higher courts. We're talking about 5.43... And there's a subsection of it, too, that has to do with move-along. So she wants the city attorney to confirm what he told her verbally on the phone, which is he told her in a phone message that she would not have to move along every hour because she was disabled. And she asked that he put it in writing so that she could show it to the police officer if there was any misunderstanding or confusion or whatever. And he has so far refused to do this. So in order to encourage John, that's our city attorney, John Barisone, to understand that not just Pat Colby, but a number of other people are concerned about this, we're going to go to his office tomorrow, 2 o'clock, 333 Church Street. We invite any members of the public who want to join us and request that very simple statement in writing, that you, Pat Colby, are because of your disability, should not be penalized for having your table for more than an hour there. You know, it's as though people want to sit there all day with a table. I don't think so. I mean, it's the real problem with all these ordinances that say you can't sit within 14 feet of a building, you can't peacefully spare change virtually anywhere within 14 feet of anything, and after dark it's completely illegal even if you're just sitting there silently with a sign and say nothing, is that they are unnecessary laws. There's nothing that actually prompts them other than some aesthetic or fear-based or gentrification-motivated notion that really sets them up. That is to say, the notion that they want only a particular class of people. The merchants, and this is not just the merchants, but it's increasingly groups of middle-class vigilantes who have been sort of drinking the toxic Kool-Aid of this drug war fantasy stuff about needle mania and, you know, drug gangs and things of this sort, which it's the boogeyman of both the 20th century and the 21st century. And in having set up this boogeyman and funded it, the government, because it has drug prohibition laws that make selling drugs profitable, because it has an economic system that keeps a lot of people out of work and forces those who are working to keep struggling harder and harder to stay where they are, it means that those who are out of work will do what they need to do to make money. And some of that means selling forbidden things like drugs. This doesn't make them bad people. This makes them criminals, though, in the eyes of the police, and gives the police great powers to not only go after them, but to ravage everyone else's civil rights. And that's no exaggeration. I've been kind of gloomily and, well, with some fascination, listening to an audio book by Michelle Alexander called The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration. And she traces the destruction of the Fourth Amendment's protection against unlawful and unreasonable searches and seizures, which essentially has been done using this fantasy and pretext of the drug war to go after it. And the drug war to begin with is complete horseshit. I mean, you don't eliminate drugs by criminalizing them. According to Alexander, Portugal, for the last 10 years after decriminalizing drugs, has had a significant drop in drug use, whereas the United States, by essentially continuing, if not intensifying, its anti-drug activities, and you think, oh, well, you know, wait a minute, they're getting more mellow. I mean, look, they've decriminalized marijuana in Oregon. Everybody, you can all have up to 3 ounces up in Oregon. Or, wow, Washington and Colorado. You know, you can actually sell marijuana, not just to medical marijuana patients. Isn't that wonderful? It makes sense that if, you know, it should be available for people who want to buy it, you know, certainly. And more important, it should not be a pretext for the police to be able to search you up and down all around whenever they feel like it. But in fact, arrests for marijuana have increased in the last few years, not decreased. And in Santa Cruz, attempts to control and monitor this using the Measure K committee have been essentially cut off at the neck, or maybe the knees, I don't know, but somewhere it's been completely cut off. The attempt of one member of the Measure K Commission, Coral Bruhn, to just get the actual stats as to where the police are going after people. Measure K says you can't arrest people for... It shall be the lowest enforcement, not you can't arrest them, but it shall be the lowest enforcement priority for marijuana, for people, not just medical, but for all recreational marijuana in private by consenting adults. It doesn't involve a vehicle, driving a vehicle. So the police department went to court with the city attorney to make sure that this was neutered soon after it was passed, not by the city council vote, but by the voters over the opposition or the indifference of the city council. And then the whole commission was stacked with, well, first the staff refused to help the commission members that were interested, so they resigned. And then it was stacked with people who either didn't know what was going on or didn't care or actively... It's hard to say whether they're, you know, big drug warriors or just plain, we do what the police department says and we trust them. But the whole point was to monitor the police department. It's not even happening in Santa Cruz, is what I'm saying. So anyway, tomorrow, 2 o'clock, 333 Church Street, some hufsters will be accompanying Pat Colby and checking out the city attorney's apparent failure to be willing to put in writing what it has told Pat Colby verbally, which is, yes, you can go ahead because you're disabled. And the idea is it shouldn't just be a wink and a nod and a verbal yes, go, sir, yes, sir, behind the scenes, it's okay for you. It should be something in writing. It should also be available to other people who are disabled. Of course, it shouldn't be there at all. And some Huff members didn't want to even get involved in this because they felt, and improperly, that this whole business of trying to thread your way through the tripwire series of downtown ordinances is exhausting yourself by playing the oppressor's game. And I tip of the hat to Elise for this particular perspective. She's a Huff member who's been aware of this and has been aware of the nature of it. She likens it to the abuse that an abused spouse can get from their partner, where the partner will keep focusing, do this, do that, do this, do that, and all the time focusing on little minutia that you have to pay attention to if you're going to do the right thing, while in fact what you're really being told is, you know, you know, you'll do what I say, whenever I say it, however I say it, and if I like it, and if and when I like it. So anyway, that's going to be happening tomorrow at 2 o'clock, and people are invited to join us. I'm going to try to post that on Santa Cruz Indie Media. Then on Monday, actually, sorry, on Saturday, the next day, November 8th, I guess it is, I've been invited to appear on, speak on radio station KSCO AM. That's never been one of my favorite radio stations, but I have been invited there to speak at different times. There's going to be a show about homelessness. Let's see if I can get the exact terminology of what it was, because it's kind of a little obscure even to me. It's a regular show that two attorneys from Monterey put on. And let's see if I can find it here. It's going to be at 4 o'clock. And I'll be facing, as the counterpoint, a guy who has written a website called Stab Santa Cruz. And some of you may know what Stab Santa Cruz is. It's a pretty intense website that blames city officials and other individuals for making Santa Cruz a welcoming place for transients, claiming to be concerned about the homeless, but saying there's a great difference between transients and homeless, and this claiming that the Santa Cruz does not have its share, which has 10 or 20 times its share of homeless people compared to elsewhere in the country, which I don't think is an accurate stat at all, and also doesn't take into account the nature of the kind of community Santa Cruz is. Or the fact that there are other cities that are far more intensely, densely populated with homeless people, mostly urban cities. In any case, I'm going to be chatting with him. I've invited a couple of other people to come on the air, too. That's from 4 to 5 on radio station KSCO. And let's see if I've got the actual details here. I'd tell you what the fellow's name is, but I'm embarrassed to say that I would be mispronouncing it. I'm going to try. It's Helbard, H-E-L-B-A-R-D. Helbard is his first name. Alcasada, perhaps. A-L-K-H-A-S-S-A-D-E-H, Alcasada. And he has written an article called Stab Santa Cruz. Santa Cruz is about to make a horrible mistake, which is essentially just a mass of sort of expressing his grievances and... he claims to come from the Homeless Services Department, where he worked for 5 years, he said. And he knows the difference between homeless and transient. And he spends a lot of time attacking, Santa Cruz Sanctuary Village, the proposal spearheaded by Brent Adams and Stacy Falls. Brent is out of town. Stacy, I think, has another event. I've invited her to come on the air, too, but I think she probably can't make it. Let's see. I think she sent me an email recently. Maybe there's something new about that. Maybe she will make it. Who knows? She does describe the fellow who I'm going to be on the same show with. And again, his name is... he doesn't put his name on his website, as far as I can see. But he is described, as I said, I just gave his name, Helbard, I think his name is, first name. And she claims he knows absolutely nothing about homelessness, wrote an inflammatory blog with zero citations or references. This is true, the last part certainly. Don't know how much he knows about homelessness, but he doesn't sound either very sympathetic, or his understanding certainly does not jibe with mine at all. Says he uses a bunch of mixed-up stats to support his claims. You can come to your own conclusions by listening to the show from 4 to 5. It's probably going to be archived on KSCO, which is 1080 AM. It's generally a pretty right-wing station. I used to show up there occasionally, but they didn't like the fact that I would occasionally mention Free Radio Santa Cruz. That Michael Zwirling, the owner, hit the roof when I did that, and I've never let him forget it. I mean, it's, he claims to be a big libertarian, and but of course, in that regard, he is anything but. But it should be an interesting show. You can call in to 479-1080, and again between 4 and 5. I think Keith McHenry of Food Not Bombs, who will not be in town, but he's agreed to try to call into the show anyway and see if he can do that. See, we'll get some interesting dialogue there. A number of people were arrested in Fort Lauderdale, I guess it was either yesterday or today, for feeding people. And that's going to be something I'm going to perhaps talk about later in the show, although it's on the other side of the landmass, but still important. Then on Monday at 5 o'clock, I'm going to be showing up at the Red Church, which now does not allow you to stand on the grass until such time as they're actually doing their meal, which is between 6 and 7. And that's really too bad. I'm hoping they will change their policy, although, frankly, they also have a general policy of it not being a particularly welcoming place the other 22 hours of the day, the other 6 days of the week. Even though the Red Church, as it's called, Calvary Episcopal Church, sits on the largest green spot in the downtown area, they apparently feel they have the obligation or are afraid of critics, gentrification-happy critics like Councilmember Cynthia Matthews, who owns a fancy house across the street, a historic house next to Jack's Hamburgers, that they have to be careful about any kind of congregations of homeless-looking people. This is a form of sickness and bigotry and must be fought, even when you see it happening among people you might otherwise consider your allies. I like Joel Miller, the pastor of the church, nice guy. And even though he's inferentially threatened me with arrest when I was organizing homeless people to protest Jack's Hamburgers' discriminatory policies, a very successful protest. The very prospect of the protest changed the owner's mind, and she once more allowed homeless people to patronize the restaurant. And that was great. That was 5 years ago, something like that. And but Joel didn't like the fact that we were meeting on their property. Although it had previously been considered open, you know, we weren't, you know, trampling the grass. He was going to break up this unlawful or this untoward assembly. We had to move to the sidewalk. We could have stayed there and made it an issue, but I've done that on a number of occasions in Santa Cruz, and we'll do it again. But, you know, it takes a lot of energy, and it also, it probably is important to do it more, actually. So anyway, Monday, an attorney is coming to town, a guy called Paul Cook. You may remember him if you're a regular listener to the show. He is the guy that I described himself as the boxing lawyer, the boxing barrister of Baldwin Park. Baldwin Park is a suburb of Los Angeles. He has successfully challenged the mayor, who's tried to shut him up. He has allegations of corruption in the mayor's office. And he's called the boxing barrister not just because he's willing to defend himself and strike back, but because he's a boxing instructor, and he's very passionate about that. And he also is passionate about people's civil rights. And he kind of took a page from the book that, well, he heard about my case, about the mock Nazi salute at the Santa Cruz City Council. And even though I wasn't able to get any money or of a court victory out of the two mayors who had me arrested, nonetheless, I think it's had an effect on inspiring people in different places to realize that because a mayor says you can't do this and you can't do that, that doesn't mean anything. Even if they make a rule and get the city council to vote on it, says you can't do this, you can't do that, you have to stand over here, sit over there, yes sir, three bags full, you know, take your cap off and that sort of thing. You don't have to do any of that. It is, unless you're disrupting the meeting, actually disrupting the meeting, that becomes the standard. And I don't speak with utter assurance that you're going to be able to successfully carry this off, no matter what you do. But I have attempted through my own both legal struggles and the way I behave in city council generally to make sure that people essentially are able to do reasonably what they want at city council, provided they don't interfere with how other people's right to speak and address the council and so forth. Anyway, the boxing lawyer, Paul Cook, was apparently inspired by my example and that of others, and he, you know, challenged the mayor, and the mayor tried to have him arrested, tried to have him enjoined, and the mayor failed, and partially because Paul Cook is also a lawyer and apparently knows how to do his P's and Q's there, and because he was within his rights in the First Amendment. And he wants to show homeless people how to file small claims court suits. Small claims court is the area where you go. I think it's under, is it either $5,000, $7,500, $10,000. It's gone up over the years. If the amount of money is relatively small as far as, you know, big money bag people go, you go to small claims court. Attorneys aren't allowed. And so he wouldn't be representing anybody. He'd be showing you, if you're a homeless person, or even if you're not, if you're a poor person who's facing this kind of situation, a person has been abused by the police, had your property taken, improperly damaged, and so forth, how to file a claim, insist that that person show up in court is who you're accusing, and get a hearing before a judge. Doesn't mean the judge is going to be fair to you. It doesn't mean you're going to get anywhere. But at least it's a form of publicizing, exposing, and shining the light on what is happening with some regularity to homeless people, mostly the destruction of homeless people's property at camps and in the parks areas and on Pacific Avenue, elsewhere, all over the town, where police officers and parks and rec rangers and boardwalk security guards and first alarm security guards and maybe even hosts feel they can certainly treat people with disrespect and with an assumption that they have no rights other than those which they give them out of the sweetness of their hearts. And they wouldn't say that to you. They'd just say, we're just enforcing the law. But the laws are created to give them those kinds of powers. Anyway, he'll be there at 5 o'clock at the Red Church, which is at the corner of Cedar and Lincoln Streets. You want to be there. Assuming he does drive down from San Francisco on his way back to Los Angeles, which he said he's going to do. And I will be there too. That's going to be 5 o'clock on Monday. On Tuesday, the Santa Cruz City Council returns to for yet another session, which brings me no joy. But Huff is going to be there, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, but specifically Cafe Huff. Tip of the hat to Pat Colby, who is going to be providing, I think, coffee and brownies. Is that, I think that's what she's planning. And it's what is coming up at the Santa Cruz City Council meeting. It is round two of two different ordinances. It's the stay-away ordinance, which may or may not be on the agenda. I'm still waiting to see it. It was postponed from last week. And it's also the performance pens ordinance. And while you brood on that, let me take a brief musical break. Take a few deep breaths, and I'll be back. So again, reminding you, if you want to go to any of these events, which I'm going to try to put online after the show, 2 o'clock on Friday at the City Attorney's Office, 4 o'clock on the radio, KSCO on Saturday, 5 o'clock at the Red Church on Monday, and Tuesday at 3 o'clock there'll be a Cafe Huff. So check it out, and don't go away, and I'll be right back.
Friday, we're playing a benefit to make some money for the Camping Man protesters. Because they need to buy new blankets all the time, for one.
Because the cops keep taking
them. Cops keep stealing them. We're playing Mark Levy, Carla Faye, Larry, the lyrical lawyer, and us, just kidding. And it says, and more, Friday, July 19th, 7 p.m., Pacific Cultural Center, 1307 Seabright.
And that is Friday, February 19th, 1996. So we're talking, 18 years ago. But that's Phil Free and Skidmark Bob Duran. You're about to listen to Just Kidding.
At Broadway.
Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Etc.
96.3. Excuse me, this is my dude. You have some ID for what?
Somebody's trying to complain against me.
Peace of disturbance.
Yep.
Disturbing in peace.
You're disturbing somebody's peace.
Okay, I'm recording this. What's your name?
My name is Hank Schoenbeck.
Hank Schoenbeck, okay. Here you go.
I don't like the way you're talking out here.
Why don't you like it?
Because you're insulting the police.
I'm insulting the police that have been keeping people down for years and years?
That have been helping for years and years, you mean?
Mm-hmm. Helping for what? Helping...
You know what you need? I had to go in there and buy a bar of soap and wash your mouth out. You're just a young little punk that don't know what the hell you're doing.
Young little punk, Bob.
Go eat.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Sergeant Henning? Are you Sergeant?
Yes.
Oh, he did. Okay.
I believe this is an actual recording of an incident on the street. Skidmark and Phil Free used to play regularly on the street, and their songs were controversial, to say the least, and inspiring as well. I played some of them in prior shows. You're going to hear one shortly.
And you're giving me, is it one, two, or three? I got a P.O. box. That's it there, but you could use my P.O. box. That's where I get my my mail. So what happens if I keep playing? You don't want to talk to me?
And I wish there were less guitar and more lyric. The lyrics are probably, some of them are pretty good. And, of course, the real key point here is that these songs are sung in the face of police repression on Pacific Avenue. And it was also at a time in 1996 when there was a 8.5-month-long round-the-clock vigil at City Hall in support of ending the sleeping ban. It was put together by a number of people: Dragon's Heart, Dan Hopkins, Shit Kicker, Sean Alimi, a whole bunch of other people. Red Top, Robert Flory were there. Just Man James Costner was involved. A whole bunch of, I mean, I was involved. Beggar Backer, Becky Johnson. These are all names that I stick on people because I like to. And there was a, it actually prompted some significant reforms, but not changes in the law at that time, though 3 years later we got some small changes in the law when there was a so-called three caballeros were elected to city council, who quickly became, well, they did what usually happens to city council members in power. They retreated hastily, and they went back on the promises they'd made to end the sleeping ban in Santa Cruz. And we're still fighting that struggle now, 18 years later. But that's nothing new to those of you who've been listening. So I'm going to turn now to some street interviews. And perhaps your phone calls. That could be a possibility as well. And let's begin with some interviews at Food Not Bombs from, I think we're talking about a week ago or so. And, of course, if you want to call in, you can, 427-3772. I should say that I was going to have a guest on the show who, I call him the surfer dude. He called me several times in the last day or two. He was impressed, he said, with the Huff website. But unfortunately, he didn't make the rendezvous, and so maybe we'll catch him at a later time. If you're listening in, Surfer Dude, feel free to call in. The phone number is 427-3772, 427-3772.
Yeah, Food Not Bombs meal, and it's about 10 to 5 out here, and it's October 25th. I'm talking with an anonymous person who has some thoughts about the things that have happened recently that concern her.
Well, when I called 911 for help, they showed up and assumed that I was the person and put on gloves and gave me the 911 harassment call, and someone had pulled a knife on me and took all my property.
Wow, and how long ago was this?
The 10th or 11th. It was a Thursday before the 11th of October, so I woke up Friday and missed my very important medical appointment because the police acted on that 911 call that the caller was correct.
And did you ever, what was taken from you?
Everything in my personal property. I'd finally gotten everything back. People were watching it from me.
Wow.
And at this time, I do not know if the police actually believed me and cared and got to it, or went to a more important call because it would be more money in the house.
Where did all this happen, if you choose to say?
On the river, just where Sherwin Oil, you know, the painting. You know, just south of the...
Sounds familiar, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, south of the... bus station. It's a Sherwin painting on the river.
Okay, and near where the drum circle is?
Probably, but it's right here on this side where the bus station is, and you'll see AA, and then you'll see Sherwin-Williams.
And you were sleeping illegally?
No, I was standing there waiting for the bus to go back to Monterey.
Oh, so you were actually at the bus stop?
Nope, I was on the river waiting, and the people came up and did a knife and were harassing me, so I snapped because I was tired and didn't want to deal with them, and I don't feel like partying, and I didn't want to be a part of them, so I was... It was us versus them.
What time was this?
Oh, approximately 9 p.m. at night.
And how long did it take you to get your property back?
I don't have it yet because I'm busy. I can't meet. The time to get my property has to be between...
12:30 and 2:30, Tuesdays and Thursdays.
Oh, right. And that's the time when I'm in my prime time at work. And it's more worth it for me to be at work than their time. And I say, well...
And we're talking about where you, when and where you can retrieve your property. which is between 12:30 and 2:30 every Tuesday and Thursday at the police station. So when the police take your blankets or confiscate your backpack or take your guitar into custody, all of which they've done on different occasions, though I don't have any specific instances recently, then you get to be without them until those times when you they generously allow you 2 hours out of their busy week for you to come in. Although, why that should be the case, why there should not be more accessibility, particularly to life-sustaining survival gear, is not clear to me. Never has been. Except that, A, they don't give a shit. B, they are really determined to make things more difficult for people. And or C, there's some bureaucratic obfuscation, maybe a combination of all three. You people inside the police department do want to blow the whistle. All you whistleblowers, let us know what's really going on there. What the real, what sinister strangeness moves in the minds of those who created and maintained this very limited policy of access to property that isn't just, you know, if it's been confiscated to you because you're suspected of being a criminal, a sleep criminal, let's say, or a sit criminal sitting within 14 feet of a building, but it's if you've lost it, if it's been stolen for any purpose, you're not supposed to be able to get it except during those very limited times. It's sort of like everyone else has to pay homage to and squeeze themselves into. It isn't even a necessary schedule for the police department. It's almost like it's been created in order to give them a hierarchical position. It's like, whenever I see police cars double parked on the street, my response is to whip out my tape recorder and begin announcing loudly that the police department, for some reason, has stopped their squad cars and are taking up an entire lane of Pacific Avenue. And, you know, if they're doing something real, like protecting a person or engaging in something that requires their immediate attention, that's one thing. But that often is not the case. There is a sense of incredible privilege that the police departments have, and the Santa Cruz Police Department is no exception.
They email me back, set it by appointment. They never email me back.
What I guess I mean is, how long did it take you to hear that it actually had been returned or had been available?
I've gotten no response because I don't have a phone at this time.
You're not even sure that they have it, or you think they do?
I'm correct. I don't even know if they have everything.
And we're talking about what kinds of items?
Well, we're talking everything I finally got you could imagine in a wallet. You know, ID, bank card, 5 different... libraries, which are very important because people can steal things out of my name. You know, they've been doing that, stealing in Monterey SIM cards. And that would be on me that I owe the money.
A SIM card is?
Something from the computer.
Now,
memory from the computer, they're very expensive. And then all clothing, gloves. I was excited about going maybe skiing this year with my father and that he didn't have to pay anything. And they treated me as if I was a second-class citizen. Then I'll tell you another time.
How did they do that? Give me more indication. How did that manifest
itself? They came up with me with gloves on and said, "Are you Emily?" And they were not going to listen to me. What ands, ifs, or buts. They listened to people on the streets first rather than the person who had actually called for the help.
Interesting. You're outside or inside these days?
I am both.
And how's the outside portion treating you?
Okay, as long as I stay away from people.
So you sleep alone?
Correct, or it's unsafe as a woman.
And how long have you been doing this, more or less?
1 month, almost a month on the first, to stay away from a bad roommate situation.
Mostly Santa Cruz or Monterey and Santa Cruz?
I go all the way in between. Monterey, Watsonville, Salinas, Santa Cruz. It's where I feel safe.
Any comparisons of the different locations?
No, it's more violent here lately. But then when there's concerts in Monterey, it's equal. It's come because of the development, I believe, at the Kaiser Center. It's become more intense because more concerts, and it brings them. And the drugs and violence, also the police, how they treat the citizens. And I had gotten up at 4:45 to get my bus back by 5:45. I wasn't even at the transit. I knocked my head over, and they gave me a camping ticket. I rumbled it up and threw it away.
So how many of these fine citations have you gotten?
I don't know, one of those, just one, because my head was leaned over. And they considered that camping, though my feet were down. I had just closed my eyes waiting for the bus.
Indeed.
The 71 by the CVS.
Snoozing without a permit.
I wasn't even snoozing because you couldn't have counted.
Resting?
It wasn't enough time. I wasn't even in the sleep state.
So
my feet were down, I was on the backpack. It was a matter of 15 minutes waiting for the bus from the time I sit down to wait, to make sure I made it to where I had to be.
What bus depot was this?
71, right? I was taking the 71 through Watsonville to get back to Salinas to my required job. And it was a matter of 15 minutes max that I sat there, max, right in front of CVS, right here on Front Street.
Watsonville Police?
Santa Cruz Police. It was here.
I was here. Okay.
Santa Cruz.
You're waiting for a bus to Watsonville.
CVS, Watsonville.
So you're also a teacher.
Yes, I am. I have two degrees.
What do you teach?
I'm bilingual cross-cultural special ed teacher. I speak Spanish, English.
How is the, you know, your housing status impacting your ability to do your job?
I have zero, zero, zero confidence in my ability because of the lack of good sleep. I don't feel I'm giving what they deserve, so I've gone part-time by the crust myself. They haven't asked me to do that, but I have medical care. I can't get places when I don't have a place, a home base, good sleep, and can trust I'm safe. But what can I do?
So you said this developed out of a bad roommate situation.
Oh, yeah. I'm going to take them to court when I feel good. I got to get to my address, and I'm only doing P.O. Box. I don't even want the police to know where I live. If I need help, I'll stand on the corner. I don't trust the police. Honest.
And what about,
I know correct police.
How about the homeless community? How do you feel about them?
They're 50-50. They can turn on you mentally. They can turn on you. I was just with a schizophrenic who went violent. I said, whoa, what's your diagnosis of schizophrenia? And then I said, are they nicer than me? He started to heighten because he started to brain train. I've had many think that if they're helping me, they're going to sleep with me. And I've got up, and I'm the one who fed them, and I've gotten up, walked out of the tent, so sorry, I think you're going to sleep with me, and I've never turned back. But I don't know what might have happened when I fell deep asleep. That's why I choose to sleep alone and tell nobody where I go. It's how you learn.
Do you find women better companions in this situation than men?
No. Women can turn just the same, become jealous and catty, and think that because you're with them, you have to follow their rules.
Have you heard of the new anti-homeless laws being proposed in Santa Cruz on Tuesday that would make stay-away orders stronger, intenser, longer for being in doing anything at all that a ranger doesn't like in a park or anywhere actually on Pacific Avenue, anywhere where the parks and rangers can patrol?
I've not heard anything about it, but if it does get worse, I know where we go 2 miles up and we stay at a campground or we stay on our friend's property, because I'm not going to mess with the power of the law, because the law has showed that I could be killed in a minute if they're trigger and control, and they will use that power in a second, because they're all about it. They're in the adrenaline rush, thinking they're doing a good thing. I've had many bruises because of them when I didn't deserve it.
Anything you want to add before I move on?
I'm ready for change. I'm going to stand and keep walking. I don't want my name told or pointed out, just my history told, because I'm going to take them to court with the news, showing what they're doing. And I'd rather have 5 police officers that affected me and they get dog training that act on the right demand, rather than human, because humans are tainted with the brain of power.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that was back, oh gosh, a week and a half ago at the Food Not Bombs meal, I guess almost 2 weeks ago, October 25th. Yeah, it's almost 2 weeks ago. In the studio with me is Kate Kay. Kate, adjust that mic, and I think you say you have a report you want to pass on.
I have two small ones. San Lorenzo Park, I went there the day before yesterday to feed the homeless. And a young gentleman said he had been cited. He stomped out a cigarette. The police officer arrested him. His bike was laying to the left of him. And they left the bike there. And apparently it's been stolen. So, and he was booked and released back out onto the streets. Another person told me that they were in the restroom by the pond in San Lorenzo Park, and they came out, and an officer was following them for a distance. They laid down their backpack to sit in the park for a few minutes and were told to leave the park. And there was no explanation, and they left. And I ran into them on the street, just walking and talking to various people. Like, you can't go sit in the park.
And, of course, they didn't give you the name of the police officer?
You know, they didn't, and that is a problem. I mean, you ask people, and how can we help you, or come and get involved with us,
mm-hmm.
You know, and they're...
Well, you know, a lot of them just want to leave bad enough alone, so to speak. But again, something you can do under the circumstances, if you have your own video camera or video cam device or smartphone or whatever, you can say, if you see the police officer currently on patrol, let's go up and take a photo of him. And you can say, this is the officer, and then you can do an interview with the actual individual. Because the problem with secondhand reports are, first, they can get sloppy and inaccurate, and there can be kind of a confusion in terms of people can mishear and not report accurately. You may miss a detail, they may miss a detail. But if they give you their first-hand report and you are recording it or videoing it, then the audience can judge the credibility of the report. It's like having a witness in court. And that's one of the things I do here on this show, isn't it?
Exactly. I mean, I spoke with a gentleman who had been shopping at Trader Joe's last week, and he said he bought a sandwich, and then he went and sat over by the bank steps, which I think is right across from kind of FedEx by Mojo's there. He said a security woman came and said, you may not sit here. And he said, well, I'm just going to eat my sandwich. I'll be another 10 minutes. And she said, no, you need to leave. And he refused. And she called the police. And he said that six officers showed up. I asked an officer 2 weeks ago at the council meeting if he could comment on that. Is this fabricated? Are these people telling stories? You know, get the hell out of our town if you're going to be telling stories. We don't need this. There's enough stuff going on. And he said he couldn't, you know, he didn't hear of anything like that. It sounded a little excessive. But the transient told me that it was a female officer, and these men came to her rescue.
Yeah, I think you told me that last show, actually, if I'm not mistaken. And, you know, I have no idea. But, frankly, when I hear people give stories in detail, and I'm asking them sort of off the cuff what's going on, I pretty much tend to find, with some exceptions, their stories credible. And police departments have an intrinsic interest in concealing, both out of misguided loyalty to their fellow officers, apprehension about being singled out by officers as whistleblowers or snitches, or just because they don't want to make their department look bad. I mean, what's Sergeant Bush going to say at the city council when you asked him? Yeah, those are probably six cops did show up. Hey, we had nothing else to do. You know, I mean, it's not going to be something he's going to admit, or I mean, unless he can create some kind of a, you know, plausible cover story. I mean, he might. I don't know. I mean, but he wants to keep his job. You know, he wants to bring home the bacon, and he also wants to maintain the good respect of his fellow officers. So I don't. You got to be cautious. And I think, you know, I often record officers' accounts if they allow that to happen. But I don't give them any particular extra weight. In fact, I'm frankly more skeptical of officers' accounts, depending on the account and depending on the officer and depending on the circumstance. You were also at the Watsonville. I guess you didn't make it to the Watsonville Project Homeless Connect.
You know, I didn't, but there's a wonderful article about it in the Register Pajaronian today.
Yeah.
I mean, I was pleased with the article. It's the front page. It talks about some successes that have happened as a result of this homeless project target South County. I wish that they could, you know, I don't know how much this cost, and I don't know how much it cost who, but you think, couldn't this happen four times a year? Because what I read in this article, it doesn't compare to any police intervention that I've seen.
Well, I don't really care if it happened eight times a year. The real issue is whether 365 days a year people's rights are not being violated and that they have legal places to go. And that has nothing to do with Project Homeless Connect, either in Santa Cruz and the Big Brother or in Watsonville, the tinier project. Not that it isn't a good thing for people to be able to have, I understand eyeglasses were made available to people in Watsonville. In a manner actually better than that what was done here in Santa Cruz, according to activist Linda LeMaster, who I believe she may have gone there. And I actually did talk to one of our Huff activists who was there. she noted it was a smaller crowd than expected, about 400 people. And there was a report that the number of social servants or social workers or volunteers outnumbered the number of homeless people that were there, which always makes me cynical because it makes me think that this is a grant-grabbing kind of activity that is primarily intended to get money for nonprofits or, you know, cook up stats so that they can, you know, expand their operations. Not that it isn't a good idea if they were really providing money to those folks and or services to homeless people. But the problem is places like the Homeless Lack of Services Center, which calls itself the Homeless Services Center, while it does provide two meals a day, while it does provide some access to laundry and bathrooms, and I guess not to storage, and I think it's no longer providing phone service. I think there's a computer access in certain places in there. They've got a computer lab. But in terms of $1 million a year, you know, I mean, there's no shelter services other than the Paul Lee Loft, which has 46 spaces. We're talking about a homeless community of, I don't know, 1,000 to 2,000 people in Santa Cruz, if not more, including travelers who are not necessarily in the same situation as homeless folks who are here and have lost their work or become disabled for different reasons, or who have lost their housing. It's mainly losing your housing, not so much your work, but one can follow the other that makes you homeless. So I'm hoping to get a report on the Watsonville Homeless Connect. I could look at the Pajaronian article, and I do appreciate you bringing it in. I prefer to get direct reports from people who were there who aren't... I suspect the Register Pajaronian writer does not have any particular expertise. There are two of them, Todd Guild and Tarmo Hanula, Homeless Project Target South County. I'll take a look at it. Maybe I can make some comments on it on Sunday. But I think we're not going to be able to get a report from... actually, I was hoping for a report from Linda LeMaster, but again, that doesn't look like that's going to happen. Maybe from you, listeners, 427-3772 is a call-in number. 427-3772, give us a call, and we'll hear what you have to say, and we'll chat back. Kate?
Why is it that more people aren't calling in? I mean, why aren't we hearing from this populace of these middle-class, local Santa Cruzian people, you know, who struggle? I mean, we have contractors out there that are out of work because the city, you know, takes a low bid from someone over the hill. But my point would be, I'm not hearing that these people realize what's going on here. This is actual police harassment and police abuse. And I'm a Republican. I mean, I'm a police fan. I have been my entire life with the sheriffs. I've always given them all
so
the respect.
So have you changed your perspective? Yeah. And have you then?
I've never seen anything like this. I've not seen... They take away blankets and backpacks and ID. How can you take someone's identification away from them? What are they supposed to do? So anything they have
get
in these backpacks...
Get out of town. Get the hell out of town, girl. We don't need your kind around Santa Cruz. Why don't you keep moving? That's a traditional thing that law enforcement authorities in many cities do. And Santa Cruz, it's kind of a sickness in these enforcement agencies. And it's also a sickness that is particularly virulent because of the power that they have and the fact of the lack of accountability. Let's hear some more reports from the street.
We're talking with anonymous person.
My name.
Right. So you say you heard about the upcoming city council meeting on the 28th?
Yes, on the 28th.
And we're all going to be providing a little food for people.
Welcome to the Shortwave Report for May 6th, 2016. I'm your host and producer, Ann Ross.
I have concerns because so many people I know have got tickets in the ticket stacked up in many cases of oversleeping. And if this becomes something involving jail time, it really, really bites. I think a
most of us feel that
way. Are you a sleep criminal?
I am a sleep criminal.
And how long have you been? How long have you been doing this kind of criminal behavior?
Oh, well over a year.
And how many citations have you earned?
2 warnings, 1 ticket.
That's
1 point banishment.
That's not many for a year. Have the police been unusually lenient, or have you been unusually?
I've been unusually, probably unusually cooperative most of the time.
Or you just keep a low profile?
I keep a low profile. But I have been caught several times.
Sleep alone or in company?
In company.
And
I mean, the times I've been caught, I've been in company with other people.
Uh-huh. And how, for example, last night, how did things go?
Last night, I wasn't one of the people rousted, but I just happened to be up ahead of time.
How many people were rousted that you know of?
3 near me.
Where was this?
Very close to San Lorenzo Park.
And were they given citations and stay-away orders?
No, not stay-away orders this time.
Interesting. Police officers or rangers?
This time, police.
Any other reports on the street about stuff that you think people need to know about?
No, not at the moment.
Want to give yourself a pseudonym?
Sure. Can I help from you?
Can we call you Potatoes?
All right.
Okay, Tatus. Thank you.
And let's see, it was on Monday or Tuesday. I think it was Tuesday. Not sure. Maybe it was Monday. Raven and Pat and John and I, for Puff activists all, went to the city council offices to look through the sleeping tickets provided by the Santa Cruz Police Department. And we were counting the stay-away orders. There were much fewer number of stay-away orders from the police. Stay-away orders have been part of the law since July of last year, where they can tell you to stay away for 24 hours. What's coming up at City Council, unless it gets pulled back, which may well be by the city attorney, is a law that vastly expands
the rich man's bride,
given a week stay
away, pride in this wind.
Given
on my good heart,
the fifth of the year, all without going to court, all without any opportunity to challenge it, and all at the discretion of the ranger or the police officer. So she or he can choose to avoid giving it to some and give it to others, depending on what
techno war means. You fight war as a production process.
Discretion.
The military became deeply impressed with big business's contributions in World War II.
Intolerable.
After World War II, the military then decided that not only would a supply operation be organized along corporate lines, but that actual conduct of warfare would be organized along corporate lines.
Without interference,
the officers were with the managers, the enlisted men were the workers. The product was ending body counts. Just as American business prided itself on high technology, capital intensive production systems, so too would our military have high technology, capital intensive warfare
to outproduce. Then let's say the downtown sidewalks or the residential neighborhoods where they do have a right to be on the sidewalks, but try to enforce that when the police come sniffing around, and either because there are complaints from neighbors or because they've just decided to do so on their own. And
we would kill more of them than they would of us.
Parks are comfortable.
That's techno war.
Comfortable public places for people to use. In the last 2 years,
there are
these
stories
have been made
of where people from different units had to fight over arms and legs
to
determine who was going to get
Avenue
the kill count
largely become,
for their unit.
Still, they have to leave 1% of the sidewalk open, or they leave themselves open to lawsuits. But 99% of the sidewalk it's illegal to sit on. 99% of the sidewalk it's illegal to do all these other things, like set up a table and so forth. So it's particularly vulnerable. Homeless people are in this situation where it particularly impacts them. And it's intended that way. See, that's the point. How do I know this? Was I listening when they cooked up this law? Actually, I was when I heard the public discussion of it in the staff report. But when you see how it's used, and you look at the addresses, and it's used against homeless people almost exclusively, or in the great majority of cases, of course, you'll be told that's because they're all a bunch of criminals, you see. They want to do things like be in the park after dark, whereas decent, normal people don't. You know, and that's...
There's irony to the homelessness, the houselessness crisis, in that living homeless for the last 41 months, as I have volunteered to do, I see transient people, like in the 60s and 70s when I hitchhiked from New York to California, having so much fun. And you see these people stopping in town, they're looking for a public bathroom, they're going to grab a bite to eat, they're going to look for a place to sleep, and they're leaving. They're going to Florida, they're going wherever they're going. These people lose everything they have with them. They have to wait around and try to get this stuff back on a Tuesday or a Thursday, and they're stuck. And to boot, they don't have any of the money they had with them, or maybe the protein bars or their water bottles. It's all been taken. What is the purpose of that?
And, of course, they are given citations, so they have to wait and stay in court or face potential warrants in other areas, which is actually, that's been always a theoretical concern of mine, but I've learned more recently that that's actually why people come back to town, to deal with their warrants, to deal with their tickets, or they are not leaving because they have to deal with the charges that the police have foisted upon them. Bit more from the street.
So we're talking with...
Hi, this is Kate Kiesler. I have a couple things to say about the homeless.
You recognize that voice?
Today I met a gentleman who's been homeless for a month and a half. All of his clothes and his backpack and his sleeping bag got soaked last night. He had nowhere to go. He asked me to take him to his storage unit. So I took him to his storage unit, and what I found there were a dozen homeless people who rent storage units for $109 a month. These little tiny things, they go in and out every, you know, a couple times a day maybe to change their clothes, to get their things. And they can't seem to organize to get a home where they could rent out rooms. I mean, there doesn't seem to be any kind of managerial organization about this. I mean, they talk about it, and they all say, well, I could pay a few hundred a month, I could pay a few hundred a month, but they're not, you know, they're not able to find someone who will rent to them, one person being in charge, possibly due to credit, possibly due to they're unemployed, they're collecting disability or Social Security, but there are definitely some...
Oh, it's first and last and deposit, or... at least two of the three. I mean, you have to amass that amount of money to begin with. And then you need additional kinds of credit. And plus you have a situation that is a landlord's market where they can rent to massive numbers of students and get the well-to-do parents to pay through the nose. And it's people who have lived here for years are being forced out of their housing through a combination of foreclosure fraud and medical costs and insurance scams, and the employment, the flight of jobs elsewhere, in which is leaves only the service industry, which pays pittances to people and doesn't allow them to have a living wage in Santa Cruz. About the only place you can get a living wage seems to be in government jobs, and you know, become a cop and get a house, I guess, is the answer, or at least get a room.
Make more money than teachers?
Of course.
I felt some bigotry with, you know, with the application processes and the landlords in Santa Cruz County, and, you know, needing a co-signer. These kinds of conversations I had with them. I was at Outdoor World, and I was speaking to the owner because I was frustrated that there were these trucks and these workers parked in Outdoor World on River Street. And so I asked him about it, and he said there's a contractor that's from out of town named MRC, Michael Roberts Construction, Inc. And I said, well, who hired them? And he said, the city. I said, well, why aren't we hiring our local people? I thought that the city was all about support local, spend your money locally. Or if that's not the ultimate contradiction, this guy is non-union. He had a dozen employees out there. And they were very inconsiderate of Outdoor World that has been there for how long? I mean, as long as I can remember. So it was a frustrating day for this Republican.
And we've been talking to the notorious Republican, Babe. Your name, madam?
Oh, Kathleen Kiesler.
Thanks, Kathleen. Or Kate, as some have called you.
We have a street report from...
My name is Leonard Ludi. I'm a senior citizen. I think Food for Not Bomb is top-of-the-line stuff for people. We need to help people. And Mr. Obama, you need to hear this message loud and clear. Food, not bombs. You know, you can't be killing people and stuff like that. You need to stop, pump your brakes, and look around you and spend the money here in Santa Cruz for food, not bombs.
If only he would pay attention.
Now pay attention to this. Listen to me loud and clear. Thank you, Mr. Obama.
Don't hold your breath.
And those were interviews from October 25th, Food Not Bombs. I think Kate has a little something.
Well, the gentleman that you just interviewed, he lives in Watsonville, and the name of the hotel is on the front of this today's newspaper, but I don't have my glasses on. He told me about this place that's a Section 8 low-income housing. He's been living there for over a year, and he's leaving. He's moving. He said that the manager there has a key to all units and that he has reported to the police a few times. He's come home once his laptop was missing. I mean, anything of value. And he swears it's the manager of this place, which I will name here in Watsonville shortly.
What's the name of the business or the hotel?
The R-E-S-E-T-A-R Hotel, the Ristar Hotel in Watsonville.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So the gentleman that you just talked to is that Uncle Louie, I think his name, he's a bongo player. He's a black man.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's been there for a while, and he said it's really quite miserable.
Wow. Well, let's hear some more. I mean, perhaps the great misery is our business here at Free Radio.
Well, Section 8 housing, there just doesn't seem to be any inspections on it. And these people get their checks every month, and there's the tenant. And the tenant tries to complain and say somebody's entering without my permission, and nobody's checking it out.
It's time for you to start a special service, Kate.
Now, you yourself are an African-American.
Yeah, I'm serious.
How does that play out in Santa Cruz?
Oh, it can be very depressing. I live in Watsonville, and there's been nothing but murders and stuff at this tag hotel, and it's been racist. They call me the N-word, the nigger, and stuff like that. It's very racist out here, you know.
More than in Watsonville, more than in Santa Cruz, is there any difference between the two towns?
Yes. Watsonville is more crazier and out of control with Mexicans. It's like being in small Tijuana. Seriously, everywhere you go, you got rude people. They rape our women, you know, and they come over to this country, they rape our women, and they want to be speaking Spanish and stuff like that. They don't speak English, and they're just inconsiderate of United States citizens. We're second-class citizens in the United States of America.
Have you had any experiences of friends being raped in Watsonville?
Yes.
And yes. White, black, or...
I had a white woman. She was raped in Watsonville with five Mexican guys.
And what is this, do you think...
And that disturbed my mind, because why would you come to this country and rape our women and take advantage of the welfare system? Like, I see the average Mexican guy come to Watsonville, which they didn't want to do. Where the welfare office at? Why don't you want to work and try to be a productive human being instead of sucking up the system like a sugar tit, you know?
You're in one of the hotels in Watsonville?
Yeah.
Have you been outside much?
Yes, I've been out through CVS. They got gangs that mark up the windows and everything like that.
No, I mean, have you been outside in terms of having to live outside, having to sleep outside?
No. I mean, I was at the homeless shelter over here. And,
115 Coral?
Coral River Street. That's a horrible place. That place...
Tell me about that.
The police do not... I had this guy named Charles Bonner. I had a Section 8 voucher. He did not want to help me rise up. He lied to me, told me that I could stay in Watsonville 6 months and I could transfer. That was lies. They are very, how should I say, squirrely about getting you a place to live and stuff like that. My backpack was stolen because the security guard was following women around through the whole thing. He was not doing his job. So I asked him, what was your previous job before you got security guard? He was a truck driver. The truck driver job is not the same as a security guard. I've been doing 20 years as a security guard. And that is where you watch people's stuff and you secure people's stuff and not run off and begin.
Do you still use 115 Coral, the homeless shelter?
No. I go over right now because I met Chris Younger, the lady, she's helped me out because I had a hernia operation. She came in to my aid, but I told her, in the near future, you should stop having people to lie to people, try to help people, get ahead, and stop bullcrap people. Because they lied and said, well, their car broke down. Once they throw you in the locker, they'll never come out and check you out, or see how you're doing, or nothing. You know, like I was in five fights out there, encountered at the hotel, because I'm an Afro-American man. One guy said he was from Iraq, and he wanted to attack me, and I had to take him down. You know, yeah.
Are there many other African-Americans in Watsonville?
Yeah, there's about four or five of us.
And how does that compare with Santa Cruz?
It's not the same, because...
In terms of African-American population?
Yeah, you stand out like a sore thumb.
They here or there, or both places?
Everywhere, you know. And then the cops look at you like something good to eat. And the ranger looked like something good. She got me for a smoking ticket down here at Santa Cruz River. The ranger, they need to stop harassing people, you know, of color and stuff, and stereotyping us and playing all these head games, you know, because they do that a lot. Then with the court, they dropped down from $150 to $8. Then when they paid $8, the guy said, well, man, we're going to have to pick up the lady roll. $250 tickets the same day. So for my money, Santa Cruz needs to stop. Pump their brakes on who to get the tickets to and check them out, but there were no signs around, and they're like, I can say no smoking, you know. That's what the judge
said. You're a criminal smoker, I can see that.
Yeah, you know. And never smoke pot, it'd be a better thing, which I'm legal to burn, but, you know, I wouldn't do that. You know what I mean? Unless it's, I'm somewhere hiding out. You know what I mean? But, you know, that's my voice opinion. Thank you a lot.
And we've been talking with?
Leonard Ludi.
Yeah. Thank you, Leonard.
All right, well.
We're on tape with a pisser of a story. Go ahead.
Okay, and the next time the Blackwater guys got convicted, you know, just like recently, he's like checking me out over the hill.
I heard about that. And so you've done your slave labor for the urinating ticket. Was the bathroom open at the time or not?
The bathrooms were closed for quite a while, and you know, and I used to go over there, you know, and I hadn't been there for quite a while because it was taking forever to complete them. Okay, and then
this is in Santa Cruz we're talking.
This is in Santa Cruz.
And now they have this 24-hour bathroom, you know, up the road here on Front Street.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's their Front and Laurel. If you ever get there,
okay.
So, you know, right good next enough. To Community Credit Union. If you ever, you know, the credit community.
Today I got the last ticket. There were had construction going at the River Street shelter.
Yeah.
Okay, it was one of the days I had like maybe 2-3 hours sleep. Okay.
And you dared to piss? What's with you, man?
So they got like jackhammers going at River Street and stuff.
Yeah.
Then I come over downtown. They got the same thing over by the library. Mm-hmm. So I can't stay where I usually would stay by the mayor's office. So then I cruise over to San Lorenzo. Okay.
Right.
And I passed out and I got up and I had to, you know, take a leak and I relieved myself. I didn't realize the bathroom was open.
Yeah. Well, they do close the San Lorenzo Park bathrooms at dawn, at dusk. And
but I'm saying that was the first time I had been there since construction, since I stopped going because they were fixing the bathrooms. You know?
Fair enough. Anything you want to add for this smelly account?
Huh? Be careful what you read.
I'll have to think about that.
Okay.
Thank you. Talking with
Dave Wallace.
You're a Food Not Bombs volunteer.
Yeah, I was bottom lining today.
And how long have you been doing this kind of work?
Just a little over a month.
And let me move over here so you can actually keep your eyes out of the sun. And you say you have a report about a wedding party.
Oh, well, yeah, we were very startled of just a bunch of dudes in Hawaiian shirts came up. And do you mind if I quickly help?
Go ahead. No, please. Dudes in Hawaiian shirts.
Yeah, dudes in Hawaiian shirts just came up and began bringing us vegetable platters and sandwich platters and a big sheet cake. And
it, today? Or?
Yeah, just today. And
where's the wedding cake? I don't see any food around here. Maybe there's a box for a wedding cake.
Yeah, it got all eaten up. It was in that pink box.
And it went pretty fast.
Oh, yeah, no, people were very excited about the cake.
And I don't see many people now, but again, we're talking 5:20. You've been here since 4, right?
Yeah, so most people have already eaten and left already.
What was the menu today?
Today we had salad with dressing. We had beans and rice. We had a vegetable stew. We had fruit salad. One sec.
And then you were completing the menu.
Fruit salad, and then pastries and bread, like we usually do.
All right, plus friendly service.
Yes.
Non-condescending across the board. You get food, you don't have to pay, you don't have to cringe, that sort of thing.
Nope, everyone gets served.
Dr. Fink.
Homeless, rich, sober, no, anyone it is. They get served politely.
And we've been talking with?
Dave Wallace.
Thanks, Dave.
And you too can sample the Food Not Bombs cuisine Saturday and Sunday, 4 to 6, in front of the main post office in downtown Santa Cruz.
And we have a report from Coral. Hey, Coral, so you say you and Bookshop Santa Cruz met today?
Yeah, on the Front Street side, I walked through a little gate, what's it called, where you have to cross through something now, like some kind of zapper.
Security gate, perhaps? Make sure you don't bring any contraband in or take anything out?
Yes. It the alarm went off. It beeped. It,
you were leaving the store?
I was entering.
And you had some contraband with you?
Apparently.
Some kind of explosive device?
Yeah. And, I just kept walking, and the woman was adamant. Excuse me! So then I had to go back and talk to her at the gate, at the front.
And what did she say to you?
Something in your bag has made our security system go off. It's like you brought something from another store. And I said, I don't know what that would be. She said, well, I could put your bag over the counter and we can find out, which I refused to do. That's it.
And did she stop you from coming in the store?
I just said, I'll just go away. I mean, I was right by the front door. I was right by the door.
What did this woman look like, or do you notice what her name was?
No, but I went back to find her later, and I didn't see her there. She had long, straight, or curved red hair to her chin and bangs. I could be wrong. She had blondish red hair. She had dark eyes, and she was maybe 25, 30. So I would go, and then... And people just standing there looking, hanging around, kind of grimacing and giving me a hairy eyeball.
Did you feel any support from anyone nearby?
No, I don't think they sympathized. They were kind of intense about it, let's say that. I don't want this interview to go anywhere. It's crap. Let me do it again.
No, you're doing fine. Your interview is great. I mean, it sounds like that you told us what you saw and what happened, and now you're going to have to pay for it.
Well,
for all those books you stole. Just kidding, folks.
No, then I went to the library to ask, well, why did your system make it beep?
Because there was, in fact, a library book. That was the item inside your bag?
Yeah. They said, we don't know. We don't have security system anymore. So, that's what I'm trying to...
The library doesn't have a security system, but the Bookshop Santa Cruz does on entering the bookshop.
Correct.
Very interesting. Well, you know, it's national security. We need to be tough on these terrorists, particularly the homeless sympathetic terrorists, which I think you probably are.
I just wondered if you would be banned by trying to go in there. That's why I was looking for you.
Oh, I have been banned, but I've told them if I'm using the bathroom, they can say whatever they want. The only person who came up to me and told me that was, of course, the former owner or the current owner or part-time owner, Neil Coonerty, who's currently also the supervisor. But he ordered me out about a month ago, and I told him, I'm looking for the bathroom. It's a city-funded bathroom, so you take city money, you got to take city shit. Sorry. I didn't say it that way, but that's what I was saying in so many words. He started hissing at me, get out, get out, get out. And this was in the middle of a...
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, this was an evening protest that others were doing against the Salinas police chief, who was giving his weighty opinion at the same time as he was refusing to release the names of his four police officers who had shot dead four different Latino guys.
And, of course, by now there's a fifth Latino guy who's been shot dead, and that's been reported on IndieBay.org. And it's kind of just a brief sort of interjection here. The story reads, Salinas police kill fifth man in 2014, Jaime Garcia, tased to death. There's a report from 3 days ago, Salinas, from November 3rd, Monday. Salinas police have reported they killed a man on Friday night. It's almost a week ago. According to an SPD, Salinas Police Department press release, Jaime Garcia, age 35, died after an officer with the SPD shot him with a taser gun. Garcia is the fifth man killed by Salinas police in 2014. Police say they were responding. The story continues by Monterey County Police News, whoever they are, to a domestic disturbance at a residence at North Madera at about 10 p.m. on October 31st. When police arrived at the home, they say Garcia became, quote, combative. The press release from the Salinas Department states, during a struggle with Garcia, one officer used his taser on Garcia, who continued to resist and not comply. During the struggle with officers, it became readily apparent that Garcia was going into medical distress. Paramedics who were staged nearby were immediately summoned to the scene, where Garcia was quickly transported to a local hospital with CPR in progress. I remind you, this is the police department report. Efforts by paramedics to revive Garcia were not successful. He was pronounced deceased at the hospital. A scheduled autopsy should determine the exact cause of death. According to the press release, the five officers who were involved were put on administrative leave. Of course, we don't have the names of any of the five officers. It took months to get the names of the officers that killed the four men previously, earlier this year. Angel Ruiz was killed on March 20th by Sergeant Mark Lazzarini, Officer Daniel DeBord, and Officer William Yetter. Osman Hernandez was killed on May 9th by Sergeant George Laracella and Officer Derek Gibson. Carlos Mejia Gomez was killed on May 20th by Sergeant Danny Warner and Officer John Lind. These are all Salinas police officers. And Frank Alvarado, who I was the only one of these people that I ever met, was killed on July 10th by Sergeant Brian Johnson and Officer Scott Sutton. And then there's a few more comments here. There's questions. The murderer, how many more of these non-lethal weapon killings can we avoid? There's a proposal for a Santa Cruz Cop Watch crowdfunding campaign to raise funds for video cameras, audio recorders, production software, training, and necessary infrastructure to incorporate as a California nonprofit. John Colby is behind this effort. He says give him a call at 428-1990 if you're interested in Cop Watch, 428-1990. And according to this, is now being called the death of this most recent victim, Jaime Garcia, is being called an officer-attended killing rather than an officer-involved killing or death. The autopsy for the Salinas man who died following an altercation with police Halloween night that resulted in him being shot with a stun gun showed there were no physical signs of trauma to his body, said Salinas Police Commander Vincent Mayorama. A toxicology screen, which could take weeks or a month, could reveal what killed Jaime Garcia. The cause of death will likely be drug overdose. That's always a convenient when that happens, isn't it? Let's hear some more from the streets.
And Salinas. So, and Bradley, the photographer, was taking photos. And so he eventually, I think he tried to cover Bradley's camera with his thumb, and that pissed off Bradley. It's a difficult situation. So, you know, I'm not terribly comfortable going in there without a video backup. I don't mind going with a video backup and, you know, then putting the issue out on media that if they want to, you know, mess around with me in that regard, because it is a city-funded facility, and much as Neil Coonerty might not like my political views or political activity, he has no right to ban me from a city-funded bathroom. He can stop taking funding from the city, and then he can, you know, do anything he wants, although I think that's petty and mean and inappropriate, but hey,
It's private property, man. Have you been talking with him?
Yeah, it's Coral Reef.
Thanks, Coral. Anything coming up on your show on, what is it, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday?
Oh, I have lots to edit, so it could be one of many things. Could be about forest defenders, could be about the climate change thing, but I don't know if I'll get to that. I might get to the Wild O activists. We'll see. I don't know.
So we'll see, and tune in, come at what time on 101.1 FM, back on the air?
101.3, I want to correct myself.
I try to get there by 10 to 12 a.m.
What day?
Thursday.
No, that's good enough. Thanks, Carl.
And we have some breaking news from Kate, who stepped outside to find some of her police friends out there. Did you show them your Republican Party credentials there, Kate?
Well, I just have my George W. Bush mask left over from Halloween.
Well,
you know, it's rather inconspicuous in this liberal town.
Mm.
But what I found was across the street from where we're located is a bus stop. And there are no lights. But the street light is, you know, several hundred yards down. And so I went to see who was sitting in there, and it was two young women. And I said, are you a little bit worried? I mean, you are sitting in the black. It's dark right here. And according to this community, there are all kinds of homeless people running around with their, you know, with their fangs looking for women to
needles,
rape.
Needles.
Oh, that's right. And both of these young girls said, yes, it's a little nerving. It's a little, we're a little nervous. I'm appalled that this city doesn't address these issues.
Oh, so this
issues.
Is a report about a street light that's out? Kate, I thought it was a report about some kind of other activity.
There's no street light there, period.
Okay,
it's not that the street light is out.
Thank you, and no thank you for that report, but we'll move on to the next report. Perhaps call in at 427-3772.
We have two police officers standing across from Zockel. He's on Front Street near the Vets Hall, chatting with Pat Colby. It looks like a friendly conversation. Yeah. And the police are dispersing as I approach with my tape recorder. But perhaps Pat can give us an update. Pat, are you driving away our poor police officers?
No, we're actually having a really positive conversation that we're on the same base about everything and their frustration because they actually do want to do their job and not
about what? About what?
About when there is somebody that is busted for a crime that really did commit the crime, that the DA doesn't want to do their job.
I'm talking about homeless stuff. You have a number of other concerns, but
we were talking about, oh God, my mouth is so dry. We're actually talking about homeless concerns because I was telling them
about specific concerns.
Like lockers for them to lock up their stuff. The woman was bringing up the fact that when it rains for homeless people, all their stuff gets wet. They don't know what to do about it. So I suggested, tell them maybe to have tarps to stop that. That's what they were suggesting to her.
They're going to be giving out tarps? Suggesting to who? You say or her.
They were suggesting as an idea.
To who?
To this woman that they were talking to.
Because I just saw two police officers and you talking.
Yeah, and laughing, huh? Wasn't that weird?
So in other words, I didn't see the fourth person. That's the point.
Yeah, she was in the bush area. So
are they actually, were they referring to her in some way?
No.
Just chatting with her?
Question.
I see.
She asked them.
Right.
And so that was their suggestion.
Right.
And then I said, well, how about waterproof items? You know, that they could put it in. And I said...
And they immediately offered to go purchase some?
No, but they said... We were talking about, you know, a drive for blankets. I could add that to the list. But then I pointed out, well, ultimately the real problem is, because these are officers that are constantly interacting at the homeless service, was we need the lockers back, and we need to find out why the lockers are gone. And so he's going to ask why they took the lockers away.
Indeed.
And how they can get them back.
Indeed.
That was Sergeant Jones.
Uh-huh. Well, I think we also have another officer, the same officer, the short fellow, whose back is turned to us. They're both...
Sergeant Jones.
The short officer?
Mm-hmm.
He had a name tag on?
Yes.
And about the tall guy?
Katrinan.
Hmm. Interesting, because...
And he was wearing a sergeant on his
hat. I'm glad that's clear, because I was going to misidentify him. And
he understood the problem with the lockers, mm-hmm. and so he said that he would go, and he didn't know that Monica Martinez was gone from there. And so I asked him, would you be willing to go and talk to them and tell them?
Right, okay.
And
well,
he said he would.
Yeah, well,
so you have it here on tape.
No, I have you. I have you telling me. And I don't think you, but I think that's good. I'm glad you did that. And we've been talking with
Pat Colby, and it's a start, a conversation.
Thank you, Pat.
No, it's not the start of a conversation. If a police officer doesn't even know that the head of the Homeless Lack of Services Center, who's been gone for a year, has changed, and is making these desultory suggestions about storage lockers, you know, the police union could ask the police department to change its hours to allow people to be able to get access to their property in a more reasonable and a more comfortable and a more extended time period. If he were, you know, that would be something that he could do if he wanted. He could demand his union make that kind of request, or he could make that kind of request to his boss. Because while it'd be very nice to have some lockers, I just, you know, I really find it really hard. The credibility and naivete of some people regarding police officers is, well, sorry. It's certainly not something I share, and that includes you, Kate.
I was there with Pat. It was me that was standing in the bushes.
Oh, you were standing in the bushes.
And it was Sergeant Jones who said to us he was born and raised in Santa Cruz. He's the short officer, he's a sergeant.
Uh-huh.
And he talked to me about the closed lockers 5 years ago and how frustrating it's been since then for the homeless.
Yeah, well, that's very nice. It is true. It has been very frustrating. What has he done is my question. Hi, you're on Free Radio with Robert and Kate.
Hello, Robert. This is John Tilting. How's it going?
Hey, Dangerous John. What's new in Oregon?
Well, we're still hanging on by a thread with Measure 92. We're hoping that it pulls out a win. Right now it's behind.
92
but it's only behind by a little bit.
What is 92?
The labeled genetically engineered foods in Oregon.
Ah, yeah. And I was reading about that happened, that there was a concern about that back in 2003, massive protests, and here we are 11 years
later. Yeah, it was actually in 2002, it lost by 70-30. Back in 2002, but we tried it again. That's a lot closer now.
At least people can have small quantities of marijuana these days, starting in July.
Yeah, and also the marijuana initiative passed, too.
That's what I'm referring to, yeah.
Yeah.
So what do you got for us, John? Any comments or thoughts?
Basically, I wanted to announce that there's going to be a low-power FM radio station starting up in Eugene in a few months.
Sounds good.
Yeah, it's a legit station. They have a license from the FCC.
Oh, does this mean
that... So my only concern with that is that it's probably going to be have to be organized under a nonprofit in order to qualify. So therefore, you probably are limited on how much politicking you can do on the air. Like, for and against ballot measures, for against political candidates.
Don't say fuck, don't say poo-poo, you know, don't say shit.
Yeah, I can't say all that ballot shit on the air.
And so forth, yeah. You know, or tits. Certainly don't say tits, whatever you do. You know, I mean, that's not going to be good. I guess you can say it if it's after 11 o'clock at night. There was some issue around that. George Carlin did the Seven Dirty Words based around a decision in the 70s on that issue. Anyway, yeah, that's good. Yep. Low-power station maybe is coming on the air. I don't know how acceptable.
Yeah, and then I was listening to various news programs talking about that 90-year-old pastor who got arrested in Florida for serving food to the homeless.
Yeah, there were a couple of them, I think.
Yeah. So he got arrested twice, and he's facing 60 days in jail and a $500 fine for each offense.
Right, and I think, I'm not sure what Food Now Bombs is doing. I'm hoping to have Keith McHenry on the show on Sunday or maybe next week to give us any updates he has. I'm not sure if Food Not Bombs is involved in Fort Lauderdale. I suspect it is. But we'll see.
Yeah.
You know. I know Keith is going to be on the air. He may be calling in tomorrow to KSCO, the large AM radio station here in Santa Cruz, where I'm going to be, not tomorrow, Saturday, November 8th, where I'm going to be on the air crossing swords, so to speak, with a fellow who does a website called Stab Santa Cruz, which is a suggests that homeless people are knifing the hell out of our fine town, and so I'm going to attempt to...
Oh, lovely.
Yes, I will be attempting to...
Our paranoia.
It's pretty intense. So
or indigestion.
And it's, you know, it's... But, it, you know, it's really the...
So what time is that on KSU? Or are they streaming?
4 o'clock, and I think they do stream, yeah. KSU
from
is,
when to when?
It's, again, folks, it's 1080 for, it's 10 a.m. It streams from 4 to 5 on Saturday, November 8th, and it's going to be me versus... is it Hakim? I don't want to... Habib? He has a name that's it's unusual to my tongue, but probably quite usual to his. And we'll be chatting with two lawyers from the Monterey Peninsula Law School, College of the Law, some such thing. And we'll be chatting, and there'll be callers calling in, and perhaps you'll call in, John. Who knows?
Yeah, I might. Who knows?
But I think Keith McHenry will call in. The issue of the Fort Lauderdale food service absurdities is going to happen. I think I will attempt to focus the conversation not on his absurdities, that is to say my opponent, which I don't think really needs to be addressed, but rather the real abuses of the city, which go far beyond the hysteria that Take Back Santa Cruz and other groups are fomenting and using as a political stepping stone or footstool or what you will.
Yeah, okay.
All right.
That's all I have for right now.
Well, get us more and call back.
All right, bye.
Bye-bye. 427-3772, we have 11 minutes. I think we're going to have an older show, a repeat show, an oft-repeated show that Uncle Dennis has asked me to put on because I believe he is wandering about some other neck of the state, maybe even of the country. So you'll have to hear his original material. You have to come in a week, I think. It's possible he may come crashing in here anyway, because I'd thought, however, that on today was one of those days when he wasn't going to make it. But we'll see. Let's hear a little bit more from the streets, and who knows, maybe from you.
So we're talking with...
Eric.
And Eric, we spoke to you before, I think it was on Monday at the Red Church, and you mentioned that, well, others had gotten camping tickets one night, or actually one morning, at the Red Church. You, because you had a letter from Pastor Joel Miller, did not get a ticket. However, was it the next night they returned and gave you a ticket, or tried to, or rousted you anyway? Did you get a ticket and a rouse?
No, I just left at 2 o'clock, you know, when he said, okay, he said, my wife's commander doesn't care about a letter.
I see, and who was the name of the officer?
I have no idea. He was just a young officer.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And how many cops were involved in this?
Four.
And how many people were sleeping there?
About six.
Were they causing any problems?
No.
So, what day did this happen?
Today is...
Saturday.
Saturday. So that happened Thursday.
So it would be, today is the 25th, it would be the 23rd, right. And this was the early morning of the 23rd?
Correct.
But now, has this deterred you from using the church property, or do you go back regularly anyway?
I'll go back.
And were you there last night or the night before?
No, I was not there last night.
So they were, and of course it did rain today and rained a little last night. How did you fare this last night?
I fared fine.
Okay. Any other thoughts or comments you have about this?
If you have a letter, that should be right then and there, right?
Well, you know, if you want to play hardball with them, what you do is you say, I have a letter, and I want to go back to sleep. And they're, we're going to arrest you. And you say, okay, fine. And then they arrest you, and then you find some hard-ass attorney who says he had permission to be on the property. You falsely arrested him.
Right. No. Yeah. My dad was a lawyer for 60 years.
Well, get him. Call him up, or, you know, call him from the grave or wherever he is.
And, yeah, right.
Yeah, thank you for the update, though, Eric.
Thank you.
And this is very interesting, because one of the issues that the Huff team and I were looking for at the city council offices by going through the 6.36 camping ban, sleeping ban tickets was to see, although we didn't really get a clear response, and we still haven't gotten a clear response from the city attorney's office, how many tickets are actually being dismissed because people are on the waiting list, and how many tickets are being forwarded to courts. We don't know. But it appears that even if you have the permission of the owner to be on a property, and you are in an area that is not visible from the street, and I don't think Eric was probably visible from the street, but I don't know. We didn't ask him that question. But I believe he talked about this before. I got to make sure I ask him that next time. It isn't then amenable to the camping ban because it's an exception. You're allowed to do that, particularly if you have the permission of the owner to be there. But apparently the police don't give a shit about this, or at least if Eric is giving us an accurate account. That seems to be the conclusion we would draw by hearing this account. So even with the letter from the head of a religious congregation who has responsibility for the property, the police seem to be completely prepared to disrespect that. And this is the kind of mob mentality. Mob mentality isn't the right word. It's the kind of sort of, I call it mob because I think it spreads in a way like something can spread through a mob of people. Fear, let's say, where there's a fire in a building or something. But I think that the police officers are picking up something that is in the air in Santa Cruz. It is a form of hatred and fear and a form of entitlement that people who are, some people who are middle class, some people who are working class and afraid are essentially jacketing homeless people with this less than credible, less than worthy, less than human status. And this becomes also a part, it always has been a pretty big part of the police department's operation. Otherwise, they couldn't conduct the drug war at all against anyone. I mean, you know, you have a complete, you know, dismissal of the Fourth Amendment, which is the right to be free from search and seizures, but the police are doing this all the time. They should not be asking you, they should not be intimidating you by saying, we'd like to search your bag. They have no basis for even saying such a thing, even though it's called a consensual stop, unless they have reasonable, not even reasonable suspicion, they have to have probable cause to believe that a crime is being committed. That's the only basis on which you can get a search warrant. It's the only basis on which you can actually, you have to specifically describe the place that you're getting the warrant for and the items that you're looking for and the crime that you're investigating. This business of pretextual searches, whether it's by stopping vehicles or stopping homeless people with their backpacks or going into people's houses under the drug war rubric, is the destruction of what little rights we kind of began to start securing in the 60s and 70s. Some people say, our founding fathers got these rights. I don't think that's necessarily true. I think the white slave owners who started this country, I have not really researched whether they respected the Fourth Amendment when they controlled the cops. It's all very well to say, we don't want the British and their troops smashing down our doors, but did when Washington and his boys or Jefferson and his police or any of the, you know, the state authorities who had more power in those days than the federal authorities, did they respect their Fourth Amendment? Because I assume that states often had the equivalent of a Fourth Amendment. And I don't know. I'm going to do a little research on that. Kate, you had something you wanted to say?
Well, you would refer to, you know, Mary Harris Jones, Mother Jones, back then when the militia in the state of California, in the state of Colorado, you know, the barons owned all the land, and literally at one point they had it so that the only public pathway was a creek that people could walk down, otherwise they were trespassing. And that's a fact.
Well, I think that's another issue. I think, you know, that's not the issue of search and seizure. But, yeah, I mean, you know, we can talk about, you know, actually I've got a calendar that talks about all the exciting struggles of the past when IWW, Industrial Workers of the World, Wobblies, as they were called, early outspoken unionists who were not just interested in higher wages but in a changed society, were holding free speech sit-ins, stand-ins, shout-ins in the on the corners of one city after another, and they would pack the jails. And all they would do is they wouldn't be breaking windows, they'd just be sitting there reading the Constitution and organizing other laborers to engage in strikes. This, of course, inflamed the corporate bosses in the different towns. I don't know how corporate they were in those days. I think they were more just business bosses. And there were corporations then, too, particularly railroads. I don't know what this has to do with Mother Jones, particularly, Kate, unless you wanted to sort of babble on about that, perhaps?
Well, we could babble on, but I have one question for whoever's listening. What happened in the debacle of the redevelopment money that is now owned by Parks and Rec? And there's something there I'm just not seeing. It's not transparent, but it's given Parks and Rec a hell of a lot more power than they had before they had the redevelopment money.
Well, first of all, the redevelopment money has been cut off. And secondly, it had to do, I mean, the power that Parks and Rec has, I don't think they got their money from redevelopment money. They got appropriations directly from the city in about 10 years ago to send out Chief Ranger Wallace on his expeditions with new rangers to harass people in the parks. And Danette Shoemaker then got together. She's the czarina of Parks and Rec. When Peace Camp 2010 protesters were peacefully sitting in front of City Hall in 2010, demanding the right for homeless people to sleep, not anywhere and everywhere, but somewhere, as they say, she and the city manager, Martine Bernal, and then Mayor Mike Rotkin, or was it Ryan Coonerty at the time, I'm not sure, cooked up a behind-the-closed-doors... Actually, they implemented a section of the law that Shoemaker had passed 2 years before, 13.04 of the municipal code, which says Parks and Rec can set rules, hours of its property anywhere.